Read together a portion from the Gospel according to St. John in chapter 13, beginning at the first verse. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour was come, that he should depart out of this world unto the Father, having loved his own which were in the world, he loved them unto the end. And supper being ended, the devil having now put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he was come from God and went to God, he riseth from supper, and laid aside his garments, and took a towel, and girded himself. After that he poureth water into a basin, and began to wash the disciples' feet, and to wipe them with the towel wherewith he was girded. Then cometh he to Simon Peter, and Peter saith unto him, Lord, dost thou wash my feet? Jesus answered and said unto him, What I do thou knowest not now, but thou shalt know hereafter. Peter saith unto him, Thou shalt never wash my feet. Jesus answered him, If I wash thee not, thou hast no part with me. Simon Peter saith unto him, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. Jesus saith unto him, He that is washed needeth not save to wash his feet, but is clean every whit. And ye are clean, but not all. For he knew who should betray him. Therefore said he, Ye are not all clean. So after he had washed their feet and had taken his garments and was set down again, he said unto them, Know ye what I have done to you? Ye call me Master and Lord, and ye say, Well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, ye also are to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example, that ye should do as I have done to you. Verily, verily, I say unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord, neither he that is sent greater than he that sent him. If ye know these things, happy are ye if ye do them. Well, as you've heard in the announcements, it's not my intention to deliver an address at this session, but simply to say a few words before we turn to God in prayer. A number of friends, as I've indicated, expressed a desire for this, that we should have a session of prayer. And as mine was the only session at which no subject had been announced, I felt that this was the only session in which we could do that, therefore. The other subjects were announced and people came prepared, obviously, to listen to the papers and to have the discussion. So it seemed that this was the most convenient time to do so, and in many ways it is right and fitting that we should do this. Although we are not quite clear about this, there are those who felt not that they depreciate the value of prayer, but that we are all praying men and women, and we belong to churches which pray, and that it's very difficult to get together to conference like we do here on these 2 days, and that therefore the primary object of this gathering should be to discuss these great matters together so that we may pray more efficiently when we go home. And I'm quite sure that that is right, so that as a principle we do not indicate that this will always be the case in the last meeting. But we must be fluid in these matters. We mustn't become set. And if therefore we have had the feeling, as I certainly have had on this occasion, that we should give this session to prayer in this way, well then you will understand the reasoning that is at the back of it. But perhaps it's a good thing that we should on this one occasion attend it. remind ourselves that there is to be an end to all we do here. Now, that's the brief word that I would like to speak about. If ye know these things, happy are ye if ye do them. I suppose in many ways the greatest danger confronting us, all of us, is the danger of being content with a knowledge of these things, an intellectual knowledge and apprehension. Now that's most valuable, but if it stops at that, it can be quite useless. And indeed it can be positively harmful, because it may drag us into a condition in which we feel that nothing further is necessary. Now, there was nothing that was more characteristic of the Puritan method of preaching than the way in which they always came to their application. They were always very insistent upon that. And I've sometimes wondered whether the trouble with many of us is that our tendency is to forget the application. There are many reasons for this. The chief one, I always think, is that it's the danger of reaction, and of an over-violent reaction against something else. It's a very subtle thing, this. Quite unconsciously, we allow other people and other positions and other ideas and other movements to determine ours. That surely must always be wrong. We should always be in control, we should always be positive, and we shouldn't merely be a reaction against something. This is a principle, as you will all agree, which can be worked out along many lines. I feel that we're always in danger of allowing an opponent or somebody who's obviously wrong to determine the grounds of argument and the matter to be argued about and so on and so forth. Now, up to a point, that's inevitable, but that's merely the negative part of our work, and it is essential that we should be positive. It's a bad state when we are just reactions against various things, because that means that having reacted against, we stop, and so our witness is nullified and becomes quite ineffective. Now, if it is true to say of us, as we've been reminded once or twice in this conference, that we are a people who seem to be lacking in an active concern and inactivity and inaction, well, it's a very serious matter. I'm not admitting the charge for a moment, but if there is some suspicion of truth here, well then I think this conference should have made us examine ourselves very seriously. In fact, I feel that that's the way one can sum up this conference this year. It seems to have been a repeated challenge along that particular line. Are we always a little bit liable to be content with knowing? And then having known, to stop and to do nothing. Now, the first respect was the missionary activity. Well, we must examine ourselves very seriously about that. We of all people should have a concern for the glory of God and therefore for the salvation of men's souls. Have we got that as we should have it? Does our understanding of these doctrines lead us to a great compassion for the lost? Have we a real zeal for the glory of God? Not in theory, not in statement, but in actual practice. Then you remember the second session, where we were dealing with the whole matter of communion with God. To what extent is our communion with God real? Now we're all clear about what's bad and what's false and what's wrong. But what of the thing positively? What is the condition of our praying, our prayer life, if you like? How much time do we spend in prayer? What kind of prayer is it? What do we really know about praying in the Spirit? Which is surely the essence of real communion with God. If ye know these things, happy are ye if ye do them. Now, if we are merely upbraided and searched and condemned and stop at that, well, we just become miserable, and we probably will analyze it still more and then become introspective and morbid and shall spend our time in utter discouragement just thinking about ourselves and our own failure. Well, that, of course, is utterly hopeless. Surely the effect it should have upon us is to make us realize what is possible and to be concerned about arriving at that. If we really have grasped what is possible for us in this whole matter of communion, well, then we must go on, and we mustn't give ourselves peace nor rest until this has become a living reality to us in our experience. And so on with all the other themes that have been put before us. Prayer again came up this morning, you see, in this matter of intercession. The Spirit's work in us, we didn't come to that in the discussion. That's the difficulty. These matters are so large that it's very difficult to take up these points as we ought. But there it is, and finally this afternoon, this whole matter of rejoicing in the Lord, and always rejoicing in the Lord. Now, of all people, surely, we should be the ones who are rejoicing most of all in the Lord, because the more you know about him, as we were shown so clearly, the more you delight in him and the more you rejoice in him. There's something wrong somewhere that these charges, these suspicions about our position should be what they are. The introduction this afternoon reminded us of that, that people normally think of the Puritan as a miserable person. Now, it's wrong, of course, but why have they got that impression? I think it would be folly to say that there is no foundation for it at all. There is a misunderstanding of Puritanism that leads to misery. There are some people who are so afraid of false joy that they're only really happy when they're more or less unhappy. There's no doubt about this. I once listened to a man preaching a sermon on the rainbow in the cloud. But you see, the whole of the sermon was devoted to false joy. So instead of going out with thoughts about the rainbow, we were sent out with thoughts about the clouds. It was just, you see, that he was obsessed by this fear of the false. Now, the Puritans, we are reminded of this constantly, were always doing that, but they didn't stop at that. And we mustn't stop at that. Otherwise, we just become reactions. We are just against the false. But that's of no value. It doesn't lead anywhere. Surely we ought, if we understand these things at all, to have such a knowledge of God and such access to God through the Lord Jesus Christ by the one Spirit, that we should be increasingly men and women who come out of his presence in such a way that people will know that we've been in his presence. My friends, we what is needed today above everything in the church is the type of knowledge of God which you had in such a man as Robert Murray McChain, that when he entered his pulpit on Sunday morning, people began to weep at the mere sight of him before he'd uttered a sound. Now, Moses, having spent his time there on the mountain with God, well, it was evident to the people when he came down, there was a radiance about him. Now, do we know anything about that? Have we got it? Is it going to be obvious to our families and our friends and our fellow church members as the result of the 2 days we've spent here that we really have been with God? That's the object of all this. Otherwise, it becomes a scholasticism. It becomes a coterie. And God forbid that we should ever degenerate into that. The end and object of all this, and all we've done, is to bring us to a knowledge of God. And if it doesn't, we've just been turning round in circles. And there's been a good deal of the flesh in it. And we'll go away proud of our knowledge and our understanding. And it won't be of any help to anybody at all. No, there is always an end to these things. I'm never tired of pointing out this, and I think we need to be reminded of it more and more. It's been coming out in several of the papers. Take the New Testament epistles. Take the great Pauline epistles with their great doctrine. Yet every single one of them was written with a pastoral intent. We tend to forget that. They all have a pastoral intent and object. And all our knowledge must be applied. It's sinful not to do it. If ye know these things, happy are ye if ye do them. There's just one other word I want to say, and it's this. I'm not sure that the danger confronting some of us, our greatest danger at the moment, may just be this. And there have been indications of that in this conference this time. There is a danger of our estimating and adjudging aspects of doctrine in terms of our own experience, and thereby limiting the Holy One of Israel. I think there's a great deal of that at the present time. Take, for instance, what was said in passing by several about people's reactions to the journals of George Whitefield. You notice the tendency to say, excesses of youth. How many of us are in danger of having that charge brought against us? Thank God, I say, for a man who is capable of excess. Oh, let's put it like this. To how many churches do you think today it would be necessary to write the first epistle to the Corinthians? How many of our churches are so thrilling with spiritual life that you have to tell them about control and being afraid, aware of excesses? How many of them? I don't know of anyone. No, you see, that's because there's no life. When you've got life and vitality, there is a danger of excess. I wouldn't venture to suggest that Whitefield hadn't his failings, but I can't understand anybody who can read those journals of Whitefield and feel that this was just a young man who was carried away by animal excitement. We were given a quotation, actually, which proved that he wasn't. We thanked God at the way he'd been kept by the Spirit from losing his head or losing himself in any respect with this phenomenal success that attended his ministry. No man was more humble. No man was more aware of the dangers. But this is what I'm afraid is happening, you see. When we read of a man lying there on his bed, badly in need of physical rest in the midst of his preaching, but who just couldn't sleep because God was pouring his love upon him, we say, this is ecstasy. This is excess. Why do we say that? I'm afraid there's only one reason for it. Because we know nothing whatsoever about such an experience. And because we don't know it, we criticize it in Whitefield. In other words, we are reducing what is offered us and promised us in the New Testament to the level of our own experience. Because there are so few Christian people today who know this real joy of the Lord, these real manifestations of the Son of God, these overwhelming experiences of the Spirit being poured out, because that's such a rare experience today, our tendency to say is, well, of course, it's not a true experience that. We're defining our doctrine in terms of our experience and of our understanding. Now, we must come back primarily to the New Testament itself. And we must see here that the people of God know what it is to pray in the Spirit. Look at them in the book of the Acts of the Apostles. Look at various descriptions that are given in the epistles. What do we know about the Spirit coming down? What do we know about being lost? What do we know what it is to be in a prayer meetings where you forget time altogether? Now, that happened here, and it's happened in the subsequent history of the Christian church. What right have we to express our criticisms? And to say, oh, this is just youthful effervescence, something which a man outgrows. The fact was, those men never outgrew that. They were aware, perhaps, that there was used certain unguarded expressions in their preaching and in their writing. But to me, the whole glory of that period is, I'm referring particularly to the 18th century, was the way in which it persisted. And we know this, a hint was given of this very thing this afternoon. Perhaps we must give a whole session to it sometime. The way these people died, it wasn't something that applied to their youth only. Some of them had their greatest experiences during their last days on earth. Thank God. You can't explain these things psychologically or in terms of age or of anything else. Let's be careful, lest we become guilty of quenching the Spirit. We can easily become guilty of this. And in our fear of certain things, we can be so careful and so wary and so cautious and so afraid that nothing at all will ever happen to us. And nothing will ever happen to our churches. And so the position will go on in utter discouragement and may even go from bad to yet worse. Well, I feel that we've got to be careful about these things and that we must come back again to the New Testament and see what is possible here to God's children, to Christian people. While here on earth, is this kind of pneumatic element as prominent amongst us as it should be? That seems to me to be the great question. Doctrine, after all, is a foundation and no more. It isn't an end, it's only a beginning. It's the means. We must never stop at it. It is always designed to bring us, as we were hearing this afternoon, by faith, into that knowledge, that intimacy, that deep experience of the living God, that we really meet with Him, that we know that He's present, and that we are conscious of the energies of the Spirit in us and amongst us. Do let us therefore examine ourselves very seriously about these things. It's very wonderful and enjoyable to have fellowship, the fellowship of kindred minds. How delightful to discuss and to argue about these things. My dear friends, I'm talking to myself much more than I am to you. What's more enjoyable than this? But it can lead to nothing, nothing at all, if we are not ever mindful of the fact that it's merely the means provided by God to bring us to a knowledge of Himself. Well, with that word, let us turn to God together. Let us worship Him, let us praise Him, let us thank Him, but above all, let us plead with Him to have mercy upon us and to visit us. Let's take the phrase of Isaiah, to lay hold upon God. How many are there that stir themselves up to lay hold upon God? That's the call to us, it seems to me, at a time like this. Here is the truth, yes, but why is it so ineffective? Well, it needs this power to come upon it. The Spirit and the Word, the Spirit upon the Word, the Spirit using the Word, the Spirit through the Word. Let's pray to God to give us this demonstration of the Spirit and of power. This thing that makes a word that can often sound so dead and mere letter, to turn it into a living flame that will do its work in the minds and the hearts of men and women.